Last weekend, I visited Springfield, Illinois. The occasion was a happy one. The congregation in Springfield, Brit Shalom, was celebrating its 115th anniversary. The Sabbath service was one of nostalgia and of hope, a very beautiful occasion. As the services ended, the chairman of the occasion came to the pulpit to make some announcements, to read a number of letters and telegrams of congratulations which had been sent to the temple. Included was one written on the stationery of the White House. In it, the president offered his warmest congratulations and best wishes to Temple Brit Shalom. He spoke of the importance of the religious and spiritual heritage of the nation. And he spoke of the concern of his administration, of himself personally, with all that could strengthen the moral fiber of the country. And as this letter was read, the congregation was noticeably restless. One or two I heard snicker aloud. Feeling the sudden change of mood, I came to recognize for the first time the cost, or at least one of the costs, that the president is going to have to pay for the Watergate corruption. He remains the president, remains a very powerful man. He has the power to command, but he no longer has the power to command respect. He has power, but he has no longer the power to make the people believe in him. I suspect that when a man has manipulated the kind of power, the levers of power which the president has been able to command these past 5 years, the sheer pleasure of his office and all of its prerogatives begins to pale. And that he continues in this kind of awesome responsibility more for the approval, perhaps the reverence of those whom he thinks he is serving, than for the joy of being the center, the crux, the core of the life of the nation. If this be so, then I suspect that for the remainder of his administration, Nixon is going to be a very lonely man. Certainly he's going to be unloved, untrusted. Whatever he says, however honestly he means it, people are going to place the meanest construction possible upon his words. And they're going to wonder not what he's going to do to accomplish his ends, but why he has set these ends for himself rather than for the nation, what he hopes to get from them rather than what is implicit in terms of the common weal, the common good. Now, I've heard a lot of conversation and read a number of articles these past weeks about whether or not the president can still govern, given Watergate. And I find most of these conversations, articles, to be incredibly naive. Constitutionally, the president remains the president. He has all the prerogatives, the awesome power of that office. He will continue to rule. As a matter of fact, he has remained what would be called a strong president throughout this whole brouhaha. Might I remind you that despite the obvious mood of the nation, which wants simply to be quits of Vietnam, he has used these last months to escalate our involvement in Cambodia, to bomb in what is essentially, apparently, a civil war, and not without authorization of the Congress and certainly without the approval of the nation. And I remind you that during these last months, he has interposed his will between the actions of the legislative branch of the government, the enactment and the funding of major programs of health, education, housing, welfare, and their execution. He has said about dismantling welfare, health, and housing activities, which are enjoined on him by Congress. He has refused to let monies flow into these programs, though they have been voted by the Congress. He has acted strongly. He has acted with increased strength during these last months of Watergate. And he has acted to increase his control over the regulatory agencies, the so-called semi-autonomous agencies of the government. Just in these last weeks, as the Watergate was reaching this particular climax, he began to increase more and more the pressure on the Public Broadcasting Commission to see to it that the public networks would, rather than the commercial networks at least, would at least be under major supervision and control of the administration. And he fought with one of the stalwarts of his own party and forced the resignation of Mr. Curtis in achieving these ends. I was given to understand after the service in Springfield that when the letter from Mr. Nixon had been received, the people in charge the evening had met to decide whether or not to read the letter. Imagine a letter from the President of the United States, a congratulatory letter to an institution, becomes such a cause of embarrassment or potential embarrassment that there has to be debate, to read it or not to read it. In Springfield, Illinois, is not, in Mr. Nixon's terms, the enemy. It's his own territory. It's small town mid-America. These are not the Easterners, the urbanites, the radical chic. I suspect that very few members of that congregation could place with any integrity on their cars the bumper sticker I saw a day or two ago. Don't blame me. I voted for Senator McGovern. This is the rolling prairie land of southwestern Illinois. It's a town of 95,000 people. It's a congregation largely of middle-class folk, people who did not share the devil image of Mr. Nixon, which has been part of the vocabulary, the mythic vocabulary of the American left for the last 20 years. Ever since his campaign in California against Mrs. Helen Gahagan Douglas, when they ran against each other for the Senate seat from California, and Mr. Nixon was accused then of what was called in those days Joe McCarthy tactics, smear tactics, the forging of photographs showing Mrs. Douglas and Earl Browder, the forging of letters, the passing of gossip, lies, and the like. These were his folk, people who believed that we ought to be getting out of Southeast Asia and that the president was doing the best he could in that direction, people who shared with the president the conviction that we ought to lower the level of political confrontation and debate, people who believed that Springfield ought to remain a town of law and order. Those who have been hurt worst personally, spiritually, by Watergate, have been members of Mr. Nixon's own party, his own followers, people who took him at his announced value, who believed in what he was doing, But they also believed in law and order. And law and order meant to them not only what it means to a liberal, the suppression of dissidents, something to be fought, but it meant to them a legal and orderly society in which the administration is under the law, not a law unto itself. The loudest protestations and arguments and anger against the Watergate is coming from the Senator Goldwaters, from the right wing, from the center of the Republican Party. For these are the people who believe in constitutionality, in the balance of powers system, which is basic to our nation. It is these people who see the consequences of Mr. Nixon's acts in terms not only of disrupting this balance of power in favor of a very strong, self-sufficient administration, but who feel that his actions have prevented their philosophy from getting a fair hearing, a fair test on the American scene. Now, Springfield, Illinois is not only an archetypical small town, but it's the town of the 16th President of the United States, Mr. Lincoln. The spirit of Abraham Lincoln hovers over that town. Just 5-6 blocks from the temple, there's a second floor office near the public square where Mr. Lincoln practiced the law. And a block away from his office, there's the law court where he defended his clients. And in that same block, there is the state legislature where he served several terms. And near the outskirts of the town, there is his cenotaph, the mausoleum in which Mr. Lincoln and most of the members of his family are buried. There could not be a greater contrast between the first Republican president of these United States and the last. And it's a paradoxical contrast given the nature of the problem which confronted each man. Mr. Lincoln comes down to us through history as a human being, as a tragic, grand figure, as a man who accepted some hard duties because they were thrust upon him and made some hard decisions because these could not be avoided, but who remained throughout human. A person who could be hurt just as we can be hurt, who sought power not for the power itself, but out of a sense of duty. We forget sometimes that Lincoln was a wartime president. He took this nation into war against itself. As commander-in-chief of the armies of the United States, Mr. Lincoln sent 350,000 Northern troops to their death, 7 times the number of men whom all the presidents of the last 15 years have sent to their death in Vietnam. There was blood on his hands, but we remember him as a healer. A man who spoke of hope and of possibility. And on the other hand, we have Mr. Nixon, who in history will go down as the person who brought about disengagement in Southeast Asia, the end of that war. There's not that much blood on his hands, yet he comes down to us who live in his day as a cold, calculating, bloodthirsty kind of person who can and will make the cold, mechanical, almost inhuman decision. His belligerency will somehow be contrasted with Mr. Nixon's peacefulness. And yet their roles and their accomplishments are so radically different. What makes for the difference of these two men? I puzzled it as I sat there that night in Springfield. Mr. Lincoln was a vulnerable human being. You and I are vulnerable human beings. He knew he was mortal. He did what he had to be done. He did not believe that life could be other than essentially tragic. There was a deep melancholy in his nature. He did not believe that one could manage and manipulate and engineer the social order, the society, politics, in such a way as to guarantee success. He was a man of the 19th century, of a vague kind of residual Christianity, of the Enlightenment, a man who had faith in man, but not that much faith in himself that he was that different than all other human beings. He knew the biblical man, the man who is prone to be sinful, prone to do the wrong. Mr. Nixon has as his basic philosophy, I believe, a strange, rather popular philosophy which combines the social Darwinism of the 19th century with a kind of capitalism of the 19th century, an individualism, a rugged kind of individualism, which sees life essentially as the jungle, as a struggle, but which believes that a man who disciplines himself, who uses every power of his mind and of his spirit, who organizes life, can somehow rise above the common herd and be guaranteed success in the difficult business, which is that of the business of succeeding. Mr. Lincoln tried to live. Mr. Nixon plans to win. Those he brings about him, those who have been appointed to administration, all share with him the same kind of model, because they meet his hallmark, his measure of the man. They are all what is called, and euphemistically, self-made men. Men who have known hard work and the struggle, who have been part of the survival of the fittest and have proved themselves among the fit. These are the kinds of people with whom Mr. Nixon has surrounded himself, obviously mirror images of his own awareness of himself. He believes, he truly believes, that the test of his man is victory, is success. And that if a man fails, it's because he hasn't tried hard enough. He hasn't been sufficiently disciplined. He's allowed himself to be vulnerable. Mr. Lincoln expected defeat. Mr. Nixon cannot tolerate defeat, for that's the ultimate cancellation of quality. Mr. Lincoln ran for the state legislature in 1832, and he was defeated. He ran for the House of Representatives in the 1840s, and he was defeated. He ran for the Senate of the United States in the 1850s, and he was defeated. And with it all, he never lost his confidence in himself or in the judgment of the people. On election eve of 1832, when he sensed that the tide of the election was running against him, he's quoted as having said, "If the good people in their wisdom shall see fit to keep me in the background, I have been too familiar with disappointment to be very much chagrined." When the good people of California in 1962 saw a good reason to keep Mr. Nixon in the background, he was petulant. He was angry. Remember that famous television speech that election night in which he excoriated the press? They had done their worst to do him in, and he excoriated the blindness of the people who couldn't see what was for their good. There was no sense of the fitness of the moment, that it might be the will of the people and right for the people to have elected Pat Brown rather than Richard Nixon as senator from California. To Nixon, to winning has been everything. To Mr. Lincoln, to live was everything. And when one is prepared to live and to accept the changeableness of life, the vagaries of life, then one continues to retain a basic faith in others, in mankind. When one expects to win, one has faith only in winners. And one loses one's patience with the judgment of the people. Whatever else he did and he did or he did not, and Mr. Lincoln was no saint and would have been the last man to call himself a saint, he spoke what he believed from the pulpit, from the podium. When Mr. Nixon ran for office in 1968 and again in 1972, he deliberately set about to speak what he thought the people expected to hear from the political platform. It was not the espousal of a cause, it was the act of victory in the election, which was critical to him. And I'm afraid that this spiritual or psychological nature is both the mark and the fatal flaw of the man. I would remind you that Mr. Nixon's sense of jungle, of the struggle, of the survival of the fittest, has been a good thing for America in many ways. Where there is the jungle, in the world of international affairs, where every government is above the law, and there are no such things as dirty tricks because there are no rules to the game, where one has power and must be willing to use power, where reason and justice count for very little except trying to put a good faith on the greed of the nation, in that world, the drive and the discipline and the preparation and the willingness to use power have stood America in good stead. They have helped to bring about a detente with the Soviet Union. They have helped to open the door to China. And strangely, they have brought us out of Vietnam when the peace talk of other peace-loving presidents somehow simply dug us deeper into the morass. There's a strange relationship, which most of us prefer not to consider, between the mining of Haiphong Harbor or the bombing of Hanoi and the end of the war. It was a dirty trick, but it worked. And in Mr. Nixon's world and vocabulary, the test is whether it worked. And on the international scene, I think Americans must give him full marks. But we are not a government outside the law. We are not still in the jungle here in these United States. We have a social contract. We are a government under law. There is a basis of checks and balances between the legislative, the judiciary, the administration, and that which is government power and the people themselves. And in this arena, the shark becomes a man-eater. In this arena, playing to win is not the way you play the game. Because if you play to win, you destroy something which is very, very basic in the social fabric, a very fragile set of relationships which permit us our freedom. What has been the hallmark of Mr. Nixon's administration? Efficiency. Drawing unto himself within the walls of the White House all that is effectively powerful, active in the government. He has not consulted with his legislature, even with the members of his own party. He has tried to draw all the regulatory agencies under the authority, the thumb of the administration. He has tried to force the State Department to toe what is the foreign policy line of the administration. He has walled himself in from the news media, lest an incautious word trip him up, lest he be something less than the person who manipulates, who organizes, who sees that every T is crossed and every I is dotted. From beginning to end, his administration has been characterized by a desire to pull itself out from the rough and tumble, the uncertainty, the lack of efficiency, which is the American social order, to give drive, thrust, a favorite word of his, dynamism, movement, another favorite word of his, to our government. And I'm talking now not substantially to the programs that he has espoused, but to the method in which he has gone about to accomplish his end. Now, in this world, he has surrounded himself by men appointed by him, hirelings, minions, and these men have become effectively subordinate governors who rule various fiefs in his name. And they have crushed or attempted to crush all forms of opposition. They have gone about seeing to it that no one can really stand in their way. You know, it's interesting when you compare labels. Lincoln was called by the people Father Abraham. Mr. Nixon is called sometimes in the popular press King Richard. Because efficiency in government tends always to move from democracy to autocracy, to monarchy, to the kind of centralization of power. And that's the movement that has existed in American life, and that's what Watergate really is. It's an evidence of an attitude by an administration that what is important is winning, is doing, is being effective, and that this is the rule, the standard, by which every action is judged. If it's illegal, it's necessary. If it's illegal, we'll find a way to hush it up. If it's illegal and it cannot be hushed up, we'll find a way of buying off the judge by offering him a higher federal appointment. Now, there's no desire for personal gain in this. The desire is to serve the administration. Because what the administration wants is that which is the mark of the right, which defines the good, which defines the necessary. And only the limits of one's power defines the possible. What is Watergate? Watergate is, in the first instance, a paranoia. Paranoia of those who have mistaken their power for their ability to define for all what is necessary. Never have so many shifty deals, illegal actions been undertaken so unnecessarily. Mr. Nixon could not have lost the last campaign. Nor did he have to have letters forged in Florida and elsewhere to see that Mr. Humphrey or Mr. Muskie was not his opponent in the last campaign. He could not have lost that campaign. Only if you sit in a goldfish bowl in the White House and you trust no one, because somehow someone out there is always thwarting that which you want to do, only then can you come to the kind of position which this administration seems to have brought itself into. You can't even trust your own party. The last election was not run by the Republican Party. It was run by the Committee for the Re-election of the President, CREEP. What a wonderful acronym. And CREEP was an organization staffed by the White House, financed by funds which somehow would not be accounted for, engaged in activities which no self-respecting member of the Republican Party or of any party who had a constituency would have allowed himself to undertake, and creep, the crawl, was totally unnecessary. Totally unnecessary. Watergate was paranoia. And Watergate was also the arrogance of power. It was the blindness that comes over those who are in power, the intolerance which they inevitably develop that somehow we cannot be trusted. Even if voting for Mr. Nixon is in our own best interest, we won't do it unless we're cajoled and managed and manipulated to do it. It's the blindness which comes to believe that where there is power, there is total power. And if I want to dig into the bag of dirty tricks, we used to call it sin or crime in less euphemistic times. Now it's a dirty trick, Halloween supposedly. If we want to dig into the barrel of dirty tricks, let's do it. The end justifies the means. And since nothing is let out, everything is under some kind of executive secrecy, seal, what can happen to me? I'm above the law. And I don't feel a criminal. I don't feel sinful. Why? Because I'm part of a crusade. This is a holy war. I'm serving God, the good, the right. I'm doing what must be done. We come here to what I find to be the most intriguing paradox of all. And that Mr. Nixon and the administration have, through Watergate, revealed to us that they share with the SDS and the militants of many causes a similar philosophy. And that philosophy is one is not limited by a social contract, but that what one believes to be right and necessary is, by the very fact of that belief, right, valid, doable. If Mark Rudd could break into the office of the president of Columbia University, why couldn't Mr. Liddy and Mr. Hunt and a few Cubans break into the Democratic offices in Watergate? What's private property? What's the right of a man to his own correspondence? What's privacy against our holy crusade? And if the Chicago Eight could sit and deny the authority of a federal court to judge their actions because they did not accept the law of the land, how is this basically different than the who knows how many in the White House who simply sat back after Watergate and the breaking in of Dr. Ellsberg's office and who knows how many other dirty tricks, and concocted a story designed to offer perjured testimony to a grand jury to mislead those who might be investigating in the Justice Department or the FBI to burn incriminating documents, etc., etc., because they denied the power of the grand jury of the judicial system to judge their actions. And what is the difference between a group of weathermen shouting obscenities at the police whom they believe to be the hard external arm of the enemy, and Mr. McGregor, chairman of CREEP, damning the Washington Post for daring to print all the lies that they were printing about the administration, using innuendo, I'm quoting him, third-person hearsay, unsubstantiated charges, anonymous sources, huge scare headlines. The Washington Post has maliciously sought to give the appearance of a direct connection between the White House and the Watergate, a charge which the Post knows and a half dozen investigations have found to be false. Strangely, Watergate reveals this administration to be theoretically in bed with those it claims as its greatest enemies, the radical left, the more militant groups in our nation. And we, the middle class, middle America, those who accept the law and the necessity of reforming law legally, we find ourselves caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, the street and the White House. Confrontation politics somehow always leaves us, the middle, in the middle, wondering how we're going to sustain the freedoms, the balance, the due process, which we know to be fundamental to our way of life. Is Mr. Nixon guilty? Yes, he's guilty. And he's guilty not only in the way in which he was prepared to admit Monday last, the way any man who heads an institution is somehow involved in all the actions of the institution, even though he may not know that someone way off someplace is doing what he's doing. He's guilty because he set the philosophic tone which has governed this administration from the very beginning. He's guilty because when people spoke to him of the possibility of the dirty tricks, he probably smiled and turned away and said, well, don't tell me about them. He's guilty because he didn't read the papers. He didn't listen to the columnists. He didn't listen to all those outside his own inner circle, even if he had not known from the beginning. He didn't check up. What he checked to do was to see that Mr. Haldeman, Mr. Ehrlichman were legally protected before he allowed them to go. He checked to see that his loyal servants were loyal and true, and then how to protect them more than he checked to see whether the best interests of the nation were served by his administration. It's really too bad at the moment that we don't have the British parliamentary system. If we had, the parliament itself could make a political decision about this administration, and there would be a vote of confidence or no confidence, and on that basis alone, by political decision, the mood of the country, Mr. Nixon would either be kept in office or there would be another election. But we don't have the British parliamentary system, and it seems clear to me that talk of impeachment is probably improbable. Impossible talk. Impossible because Mr. Nixon is a lawyer, and he has surrounded himself with very competent legal advice. And I am sure that in the narrowest sense, he can prove that he acted within the law. But that's really not the question, is it? Because in every other sense, in terms of the philosophy of his administration, in terms of his choice of servants, subordinates, in terms of his action or inaction since the Watergate broke in July of last year, in terms of his desire to protect his own rather than to serve the common good, in terms of his acceptance of dirty tricks as part and parcel of the American system, the line in the speech of Monday last, where both major parties have been involved in actions of this type in the past, he has shown himself to be essentially blind, deaf and blind, to one basic democratic necessity, the necessity of preserving the rule of law, government by the people, for the people, and of the people. Let me end by quoting Mr. Lincoln. Mr. Lincoln said sometime during his first administration, when people had brought to him evidence of gross mismanagement of the logistical services of the Army, he was being accused of being in collusion with those who were making fortunes off the Civil War. He said, when the people retain their virtue and their vigilance, no administration by any extreme of wickedness or folly can very seriously injure the government in a short space of 4 years. I think here is my hope. I think the media, particularly the newspapers, have been alerted again to the role which they must play in our American society, to be our eyes and our ears and our nose, to ferret out and to expose. And they've had in the example of the Washington Post a noble example of the true role of newspapers and of the media in our society. And I think the judicial system, both in the conduct of the current grand jury investigation and in the conduct of the trial of those who were immediately involved in the Watergate break-in by Judge Sirica, and in some of the actions of the California judge who has been handling the Ellsberg trial, the judicial system has recognized its role in preserving the balance and is prepared to act administratively as well as judiciously in order to achieve this. And ultimately then, during the next 3 years, it becomes our responsibility as people to see to it that our legislators become more effective than they have been. Part of Watergate occurs because the Senate and the House have become such ineffective instruments to impose upon the country the popular will. We must see to it that we remain alert, and concerned, and demand conviction of those who serve us. But then I suppose we must do what Americans have had to do over the long decades, and that's simply to have faith in the complexity and in the checks and balances with it which exist within our system. For if Watergate teaches anything, it's that there is nothing structurally wrong with our government. Those who were involved, to a large degree, have been exposed. The chicanery, the criminality is coming out. But what we must do is to be vigilant that no arm of government ever is allowed to arrogate such power unto itself, that we become its servants, not its masters. When the people retain their virtue and vigilance, no administration, by any extreme of wickedness or folly, can very seriously injure the government in the short space of 4 years. That I firmly believe. Amen.